It was a harsh winter, and it was particularly hard on Iowa's honeybees. Experts estimate that 65 to 70% of the state's honeybees did not survive. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. We'll talk about the plight of Iowa's honeybees, and we'll also talk about pesticides that may pose a further risk to honeybees and other pollinators in the state. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here, and he and Donald will answer your questions about plants and insects. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and one of these Fridays, it's going to start feeling a little bit like spring. I promise. ISU horticulturist Richard Giron will join us soon. But first with me is Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Good morning, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Glad to be here.
Well, and winter doesn't seem to be quite done with us yet, but we're going to talk about some of the damage that this winter did do. And that's to honeybee populations in Iowa. This has been in the news quite a bit lately, but this very harsh winter was really hard on honeybees.
Yes, but for a variety of reasons, and it's not just the cold. People who have been hearing Andy Joseph, our state apiarist from the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, hear a long list of problems that honeybees have faced in recent years, and especially last year with some drought and some other problems. And he refers to the cold winter as one more paper cut, and that the decline in honeybee populations, especially the recent decline through the winter, was death by 1,000 paper cuts. So there's lots of little things going on. And yes, the winter was bad. Yes, the winter may have been the last straw, but it takes more than just cold temperatures to interfere with insects and plants and other animals and so forth that have survived this and worst. For tens of thousands of years.
So in spite of the extreme cold this winter, honeybees could have made it through. They should have been able to make it through.
They should have been able to if they were healthy and well-fed and not troubled with diseases and parasites and the other things that weaken them or stress them. And some did. Obviously, we're hearing this figure of 65 to 70% colony loss. Well, that means 30 to 35% did make it. Now, that's not a sustainable rate of loss, and that's a terrible hardship on those who did lose their colonies. But bees can make it through this kind of a winter, and they have in the past. It's the accumulation of stresses that is a little different for our honeybees right now.
All right. Well, let's talk about that accumulation of stresses. In particular, I want to talk about a particular kind of insecticide that a lot of people believe is really affecting our honeybee populations. In fact, this kind of insecticide has been banned in Europe because beekeepers in Europe felt that it was interfering with honeybees there. The neonicotinoid insecticides, when they were introduced, the idea was that they would have a lower impact on the environment, right?
Exactly. They are effective at very low doses at controlling insects, which means they have less impact on non-target organisms around us. So from a human safety point of view, these were a giant step forward. We now had insecticides that were effective against insects at very low doses and appeared to have no impact on people, such as applicators who were handling and applying the insecticides. They've been around a long time. Many of them are very familiar to us. And this was another class of insecticide that came on to replace the previous classes of insecticides that we had found problems with. So we go back to the ages of chlordane and heptachlor and dieldrin, and we didn't like those because of their persistence. So they were replaced by a class of insecticides called the organophosphates. And Dursban and diazinon and some others seemed like a giant step forward, but then, no, we found problems with them. So that group was replaced by this new group called the neonicotinoids. And if you just break that word apart, it explains to you what it is. The middle of the word looks like nicotine, And it is. It's a chemical that is like nicotine, as you get from the OID suffix on the end. It's a nicotinoid, which means it's like nicotine. It's not nicotine, but it's like it. And neo on the front means it's a new class of chemistry. So neonicotinoids mimic the action of nicotine, which is a natural insecticide that has been inside tobacco and other plants for a long number of years.
And how do they tend to be used?
They're used everywhere. We started out with them in agriculture, which is where most insecticides are introduced because it's a huge market and the manufacturers can recoup their development costs more quickly there. So they're used in agriculture, and it moved from there into trees and shrubs. And more recently, it's also moved into certain fruits and vegetables. So we use them in a wide number of places, everything from treating our turf grass for white grubs to keeping some of the early insects off of our melons and other plants first thing in the spring.
And they're often used as a systemic insecticide?
They are systemic, which means once they are in the plant, they will move around. And this is variable with the compound. It varies a little bit with the plant, of course. But one of the huge advantages of the neonicotinoids is you can put it in the ground and not have to spray the entire tree because the roots will pick it up from the soil in the ground. The insecticide will move through the tree and up into the leaves where there may be something like aphids or scale insects or something feeding on it. So the insecticide is in the plant, and we can do that with what seems like a lot less environmental impact because we're not spraying the tree. We're not putting insecticide up in the air. We're dropping it or injecting it into the ground or into the potting soil of plants in the greenhouse and so forth. Because of this systemic action, it eventually gets to where the insects are feeding without having to put it there directly.
Okay, so in the coming weeks and, I guess a couple of months, since spring seems to be a little bit late this year, many, many farmers in Iowa will be planting seeds that are coated in this kind of insecticide, right?
That's one of the developments that has come about, is that the seed companies have found a way to put that insecticide on the seed to provide a little protection to the plant very early on. So the insecticide that's on the outside of the seed dilutes into the soil as the plant germinates and as the roots start to grow. The insecticide can be taken up by the plant to offer that protection to it. Sounds like a marvelous, simple way to do it. I don't have to go back and spray my field. I don't have to make a second pass. I don't have to spend more money for diesel fuel to spray the field because the insecticide went on at the same time as the seed went in the ground. The downside is some of that insecticide that's on the seed coat blows off of the seeds as the seeds are handled in the planter, and that distributes it around the environment near those fields. And research here at Iowa State University picked up these insecticides on dandelions and other plants nearby.
Now, I know a lot of farmers would like to continue using these insecticides and not damage the environment, not damage pollinators. Mm-hmm. Are there efforts being made to control that dust?
Lots of them. And the seed companies and the insecticide companies recognize what has happened with the insecticide that they thought was going into the ground and that some of it was escaping. So better coating technologies will come about. Maybe there's ways we can improve our planters to stop this dust from escaping into the air, that it's all self-contained on the machinery or inside the machinery. So this is an area that's ripe for research, and lots of people are looking at this. And all of these problems, as soon as they're exposed, somebody somewhere says, I can do this, I can fix this problem, and we can maintain these tools and have these options available to us. All we have to do is use them just a little bit smarter, and so it will happen.
Now, with these insecticides, though, they are systemic insecticides. Do they travel through the plant and get into pollen and nectar through the plant? Are they also causing a threat to pollinators that way?
Yes, that's the unfortunate part of this, that early on we thought, well, the insecticide's in the plant, it goes up and it comes out into the leaves, and there it is to control insects. But it wasn't that simple. Some of the insecticide that's inside the plant is also moved into the flowers and maybe in the nectar and pollen. But one of our huge voids in our knowledge base is how much. How much of this insecticide that we put on the soil went up through the plant and is now in the nectar or pollen? We know there is some there. We know that it's a concern, and this is an area that's getting a lot of discussion and a great deal of attention right now is how much of this moves into the flowers. In the meantime, what we're suggesting for homeowners and others is very carefully consider if this is what you need to do, and this is going to intersect very abruptly with large portions of the population of Iowa as we look at protecting ash trees from the emerald ash borer with one of these systemic insecticides. Not that bees feed on pollen and nectar from the ash trees themselves, but if you have put that insecticide on the ground for the ash tree to take it up, are the nearby flowering shrubs also picking up that insecticide and then impacting the pollinators that are feeding on nectar and pollen? So we have a lot of questions, and I don't think it's an easy answer. There is no one answer just yet, but we need to keep asking these questions, and we need to think very deliberately and use our pesticides judiciously.
So with the treatment for the emerald ash borer, you're saying that we could see a lot greater use of these kind of insecticides in Iowa?
Well, we will see an additional use that we haven't seen before. We've used these insecticides on trees and shrubs for very specific problems, but as we look at emerald ash borer now in 9 locations within the state, likely to go higher over the coming years, more and more people will be faced with this decision of what do I do about the ash tree that I have in my yard and that I love? Am I going to replace it? Am I going to wait and see what happens? Or am I going to try to protect it with insecticide? And smaller trees can be protected by putting the insecticide on the ground where it could be picked up by other plants. The alternative is the injection of the insecticide just under the bark of the ash tree, which means the insecticide is only in the ash tree. And that may be the compromise we have to make, is to say protecting ash trees, especially if there are other flowering shrubs nearby, should be done with this injection as opposed to the soil treatment.
If I want to encourage pollinators and have healthy pollinators on my own property, is it safe to go to a yard and garden center and buy plants, or is it possible that they've been treated?
In the greenhouse, where the environment is ideal for growing plants, it's also frequently an ideal environment for growing insects. And one of the things consumers expect is that when plants come out of the greenhouse, go into the garden center, and I pick them up, I expect them to be pest-free. So yes, insecticides have been used on those, and that's another area that we're looking at.
All right. Well, we'll continue our conversation in a moment. I'm talking with Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist. And of course, he'll answer any questions you have about insects. And in just a moment, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be joining us to answer your questions about plants. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Joining us now, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
And I just happened to think of a new phrase this morning. April snow showers delay May flowers. I'm sure that I'm the first person to ever think of that as I was getting hit by small flakes of snow and sleet. This morning. Lovely day.
Yes. But well, the ground was white here in Ames. Apparently, they had 3 to 4 inches in northern Iowa. So, but again, when you think of last year, we had 2 or 3 inches in early May, too.
Right.
So.
We remember. I think we all remember that
this is
very
Iowa. So.
And is this the time? We've talked about it a few weeks in a row. This is the time to start planting seeds if you're starting your own tomatoes?
Right. You can start them inside, correct. But as far as outside activities, I'm thinking we're maybe a week or two behind. So as far as planting lettuce and spinach and radishes, hopefully maybe by next weekend, hopefully.
And if the ground is frozen and you cannot, you can't actually get a spade in there, you probably shouldn't plant.
Or it's too wet, yes.
All right, just a rule of thumb. Mm-hmm. You can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Mary is on the line in southeastern Iowa. Hello, Mary.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is about squash borers, and I suppose a related question is tomato worms. We've had a really hard time with all our squash crops and with the little crawly things that get under on the ground and then chew through the stem.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd like to control them naturally, but have had no success, even moving areas and what have you. I wondered about the systemic insecticides, although I don't know how much I want to use them, really.
Yeah. No, food crops are one of the places we don't like to use systemics, although our commercial vegetable growers do occasionally use a systemic insecticide, but it always has to be very early in the season on a crop that's going to take a very long time to mature so that that insecticide has dissipated by the time the fruit is forming. Squash vine borer is a moth that will seek out your squash wherever you hide them. It doesn't matter that you moved them from one corner to the next. It doesn't matter that you put them behind the pole beans and can't see them. The moth will find them. And in about mid-June, that female moth will fly during the daytime. Yes, she's a day-flying moth. That's just weird. She will fly and find those squash and lay her eggs on the base. So in mid-June, we need an insecticide protectant on the stalk, on the base of the plant. And that's a little hard to do. You have to have a spray rather than a dust. The traditional insecticides like 7 and bifenthrin and some of the others will help in that. An organic treatment is going to be a little harder to pull off to find something that's going to stick there and protect the plant for a period of time. So you're right. Squash have really had a problem with squash vine borer. The squash bug has been terrible the last two seasons, as have some other pests.
Okay, just keep doing what we're doing, I guess.
I think you're on it. Remember that critical time is mid-June, and if you're far enough south, maybe you ought to be thinking about early June, and the protection needs to be on the base of the plant, not on the foliage.
Okay, we've tried foil around it and scraping off the eggs and all kinds of things, but we'll keep trying.
You're on it, then. If you're willing to go out there and scrape eggs off of the base of squash plants, you're a good gardener is what I would say.
No, thank you very much.
Mary, thanks a lot for your call. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. And I have an email from Judy. And Richard, you may remember this one. A couple of weeks ago, she sent an email that said this. I built two raised beds in order to more easily grow root crops, turnips, carrots, parsnips, and filled the beds with a soilless mixture. Nearly every vegetable was damaged by tunneling, I presume from some kind of worm. What can I do to cleanse my growing medium? You asked for more information, so now she has sent us more. Yes. The tunneling, as you surmised, appears to be caused by some larva. The damage is alongside as well as in the center of the root, 1/16 inch to 1/8 inch wide and deep, where the critter has pierced the root. The hole is pinhead size or smaller. Tomatoes grow well, also arugula, even sunflowers in these beds. Last year's bell and chili peppers and leeks didn't do too well, but the fruits and leaves were undamaged. The growing medium consists of roughly equal parts of sphagnum peat moss, vermiculite, and mixed packaged manures. Walls of the beds are standard concrete blocks. Could some weed, I confess to having a few, despite newspaper mulch, be attracting or harboring a pest that has taken a liking to my root crops? We have a neighborhood cat that's fond of the beds. I've covered the beds the last 2 years with poultry netting to keep him out and have cleaned up the deposits from the first year. Could feces residue be responsible? All right.
All right. That's a whole lot of questions.
Yes.
Tunnelers inside roots of root crops. Remind me again, what crops were damaged?
Let's see, carrots, turnips, and parsnips.
Okay. Well, we immediately think of wireworms and white grubs, but that shouldn't be happening in a raised bed of fresh soil. We would think about making sure there are no grasses and weeds there in the previous year. But since we didn't take this out of sod, that shouldn't be an issue. And the holes sound kind of small for wireworms and white grubs. I'm wondering if this isn't something secondary, that there are fly maggots and some other things that will go into decaying plant tissues, especially if they're in a wet environment, like, well, overwatered garden might be one of them, that the holes are secondary to something else that might have begun decay. But in my opinion, no, it's not the few weeds. No, it's not the neighbor's cat. And no, it's not the cat droppings that are left over. I think this is something that has come on its own, probably flew in after the plants were up.
Okay, so what can she do?
I think she needs to keep trying. Raised bed should have good drainage, and so that's not going to be an issue, but maybe make sure and follow Richard's advice on watering so that the soils aren't very soggy, and make sure mechanical injury doesn't happen when transplants are going in the ground and so forth.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. Next up is Craig in Grundy County. Hi, Craig.
Morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I was wondering about mountain ash being affected by the emerald ash borer.
No.
No.
Nope. Mountain ash is not an ash.
Right. Mountain ash is actually belongs to the genus Sorbus, and the true ashes are Fraxinus. Now, the mountain ash doesn't do well in Iowa because it's not well adapted to our climate. It hates hot, dry summers. And so in Iowa, typically, if we plant it, eventually the heat and the dryness catches up with it, and then it weakens the plant, the tree. And then you have things like borers and cankers. They attack the weakened tree, and they kill it. So typically in Iowa, mountain ash trees survive maybe 10 or 15 years, and they're gone.
But not because of this particular species. There are other borers that are, have always mm-hmm. been here that will attack that particular plant, but not this one.
All right. Okay, good news, Craig. Thanks a lot for your call.
Okay, thank you.
It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have an email from Jennifer, and she was enjoying our conversation about neonicotinoid insecticides and bees, and she wanted to just sort of clarify the relationship between these insecticides and colony collapse disorder. And the relationship is not entirely proven and not cut and dried, right, Donald?
Exactly. Colony collapse came on the scene back in about 2006, and we had been losing honeybee colonies before that. But this particular syndrome of the bees disappearing in spite of having available food and having immature bees in the colony, that was a new problem. And the insecticides that were also in play then became a likely target. And the more we have looked at colony collapse, the more the EPA, the USDA, beekeepers around the world are agreeing that it is not one thing. It is not the insecticides. It is poor nutrition mixed with parasites, mixed with virus diseases, adding on to the fungal diseases, adding on to the stress of the beehive from treatment of the mites inside the beehive to the insecticides outside. You stir all that big conglomeration of things together and you get colony collapse. It is not just the insecticide.
All right. But as you mentioned, they're dying this death of 1,000 paper cuts, and this is a serious paper cut.
This is one more. Yep.
All right. And I have to mention this because I was doing some bee research before the show today, Donald, and I came across some very important new research from a young man who is a graduate student at Cornell University. And he decided to, on himself, test to find out where the worst places to get stung by bees are. And he systematically tested every single part of his body. This is information that was published in National Geographic today. And so I'm sure you're dying to know the very worst place is the nostril.
Uh-huh.
Second is the lip. And again, this is one researcher. This was not a multi-gender study. The third place is the penis. So,
and just in the
great
interest,
advice,
the interest of science, that here's a student that repeatedly, not just once, but over a period of a month or more, held bees against the various parts of his body and allowed them to sting him, and he rated the pain. And of course, this has been going on for some time, that pain is something that's associated with the stinging of social insects like bees and yellow jackets and bald-faced hornets and bumblebees and so forth. And the pain is to make you remember, don't come back. So,
are you saying there may be something wrong with his memory?
Well, no, I just think he's an incredibly curious person and probably much more curious than the rest of us to have not only done the study, but to have replicated the study, to have gone back and stung these places again and made another calculation, another observation, and written down his data so that he could analyze it. But the pain is something that is different for different insects, and it's amazing that we didn't already know from previous research where is the most painful part to get stung. I've been stung on the lip. I know that one hurts. I don't have experience with the others, and after reading that study, I don't want to.
Right. No, I think very few people do, and he doesn't expect any researchers to follow in his footsteps. Although the three best places to get stung by a bee are the top of the head, the upper arm, and there was, the top of the middle toe.
Right, that these are all different places. And it's interesting, in that study, it's not what you might expect. You might think, oh, it's going to hurt most on really thin skin, like on the back of my hand or something like that, or the thin, tender skin. But one of the places that hurt the most was to be stung on the palm of your hand. And you think about how tough the palm of your hand is, and yet to be stung there was more painful than to be stung on your forearm. It's an interesting observation, and I hope he's wrong. I hope someone does replicate this somewhere else so that we have additional data on
which to do. Are you volunteering?
No, I think this would be a young scientist's job.
A young scientist, sure. All right, let's get back to the phones. Mike is on the line in Earlham. Hello, Mike.
Hi, I just had a question about cutting volunteer trees out, hedge, Osage orange, mulberry, and thorny locust. When I cut them, of course, the next year I've got a dozen volunteers coming up from that stump, and I want to know what to treat the stump with to kill it and not have any carryover damage to the surrounding trees or plants.
Right, I would use Roundup.
Roundup and,
right.
and concentrated, or just you know, what's available commercially or what?
The concentrated form, right. The concentrated form. But basically, I might be inclined to wait a few more weeks until the trees begin to leaf out, so they're actively growing, so you get good herbicide uptake. And then I would cut them off and paint them immediately.
Okay.
Just paint that cut, right?
Right, paint the cut. And when you do that, try to apply the material to just beneath the bark. That is a living tissue, and that living tissue should absorb it and translocate it down into the root system, and that should kill the tree completely. So there's no need to really treat the center of the stump, more toward the outer part.
So the part that's easiest to treat is the one I don't need to treat.
Right.
Okay.
Toward the outside.
Just to be clear.
any surrounding, some of these are a little bit close to, I've got some grapes and some mm-hmm. other things. So that, will that, you know, when it goes down into the root system, will that have any carryover potential for the?
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay, great.
Roundup has to be absorbed by living tissue. And so once it's in the root system, that's it. Now, let's say you had a crab apple and it was producing suckers and you applied the Roundup to the suckers. That very well could kill the tree because they're coming from the root system of that tree. So, but if you're trying to kill something, no problem, just apply it to the cut surface.
On a dry day, so that there's no rain to wash off your herbicide and move it with the rainwater, so do it on a dry day as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Mike. Next up, let's go to Vicki in Iowa City. Hi, Vicki.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I have had beehives for several years, this year in the fall, I treated for varroa mites with Apligard, which is thymol. And I treated kind of late, so I didn't get it out of there as quickly as I should have. And this winter, all my bees died. And I think they died pretty early on because the frames are still full of honey. Unfortunately, the honey that's in there tastes like thyme. So I'm wondering what I should do with this hive at this point in time.
Wow, that's a very specific question for which you need an experienced apiarist. I think I think Andy Joseph would be a good choice for you.
Okay.
The other people who have a wealth of information and are willing to share are the members of the Iowa Honey Producers Association. And if you do a web search for Iowa Honey Producers, you'll come up with their website, which is abuzzaboutbees.com. So look up Iowa Honey Producers, and you'll find a regional representative under contacts. And that's somebody in your portion of the state who can help you answer questions like that. And also maybe help you, now that we're kind of late into the season, of finding replacement bees for that hive.
Vicki, thank you so much for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to answer more of your questions about plants and insects in a moment. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. And you are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. Paul is on the line next from Davenport. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, Davenport, Iowa's got this terrific compost facility, and they sell compost, potting soil, and garden soil at a pretty reasonable price. And last year I built a raised garden, and I bought some of this garden soil, which is compost, sand, I think some waste products from the water treatment plant and so on. And my question is should I add compost to that garden soil in this new growing season?
I would think you don't have to. You shouldn't have to, no.
Okay. The other question is when I use this type of stuff, it seems like I have to water more often. Would I be better off mixing some clay or black dirt in there to keep so I don't have to water as often?
Well, I would definitely not add the clay. I mean, if you had some good, well-drained soil, you could work that in, a little bit of that. Typically, if you're going to make your own, let's say, mix for a raised bed, if you have a source of compost and some coarse sand and some good, well-drained soil, if you mix those in equal volumes, that should give you a pretty good soil mix for a raised bed if you're making your own.
Okay. All righty. That's all I had.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And next up, let's go to Carol in Delaware County. Hi, Carol.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. What would you like to ask?
Well, back in January, I started some flowers, and then the beginning of March, I started my tomatoes. And they're doing quite well, but I was wondering if I should be feeding them.
Okay, what are they growing in?
Seed starting mix.
Okay. Now, if they're in a seed starting mix, did they add maybe some fertilizer to the mix? Because some do.
Yeah, some do, but, you know, like the flowers, they've been in there since January. I just, you know, and they're very healthy plants, so I'm just kind of wondering if they're starting to drain the soil a little bit.
Well, I would base it on their growth rate and their appearance as far as color. If they still have good color, nice dark green, mm-hmm. Seem to be growing well, okay, not too quickly. They're not stunted, but they're not growing too quickly. I would be inclined not to,
mm-hmm.
just because I don't want to get these very large, tall, spindly plants.
Right.
So if you overdo it, that's what you're going to end up. You're going to end up with this tall, lanky plant, which really is not the best plant.
No.
So if they're growing well presently, if they mm-hmm. have good color at the present time, I probably would not fertilize right now. No.
Okay. Thank you. I wasn't quite sure. I mean, I'm using well water on them, so mm-hmm. they're getting minerals and such. But yeah, I just didn't know at this point on some of the plants. Some of them are probably 4 to 6 inches and very bushy.
Okay.
But the color is very good.
Okay. Good.
I just didn't know if I should be feeding them. I know the Amish, they use like a fish.
Mm-hmm. Fish emulsion.
Some kind of fish water on theirs. But.
Or you can also use one of the water-soluble products like Miracle-Gro. That works fine, too.
Okay.
Just make sure that if you do fertilize, it's a very, very dilute solution.
All right, Carol. Thank you so much for your call. Next up, let's go to Cheryl in Iowa City. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. This winter, I got some winter burn on my evergreen yews, so I've got some brown needles, and I was wondering if I should trim that back, and if so, what time of the year?
That's been a very common occurrence this year, winter burn on various evergreens, chiefly yews, some of the spruces, some of the pines. I would be inclined to wait, because at the present time, the true extent of damage is not known. The damage may be limited to the needles. The branches of buds may be perfectly healthy. And if the branches and buds are healthy, they'll break bud in a few weeks and put on some new growth, and the brown needles will fall off. Everything will be fine. Okay. On the other hand, it was a very difficult winter, and in some cases, maybe some of the branches also have died. And so you're not going to see any new growth at all. But that's probably not going to be apparent to probably mid-May or so. So I'd be inclined to just kind of wait and see what they do. And if there are areas in mid-May that are still totally brown, no new growth coming out, then I'm assuming they're dead, and I would prune those areas out.
All
great.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call, Cheryl. Let's get to some email questions. We've got a bunch of these. This is from Kevin. He says, our backyard is surrounded by privet hedge. It was a head tall when we moved in 3 decades ago, but after a time it got into a routine of dying every few years. We cut it off and it starts over. This winter the leaves did not drop off. What do you think that's telling us about how it will do this spring? Any long-term advice about how to handle this?
Well, if the leaves are still on, that would maybe suggest they have died back again, unfortunately. Since this has been a reoccurring thing, I might be inclined to possibly rip it out. It's going to be a lot of work. And replace it with something else, possibly, that's more dependable. Maybe some dogwoods, viburnums, whatever, but something else, lilacs, something that's more reliable.
You're telling me privet is not reliable?
Not always, no.
Okay.
Not always.
All right.
So that would be my suggestion.
Okay. This is from Gary. He says, I live in Clive. Should I have my ash tree treated, and does it work, or should I just wait to see if it gets hit by the insect?
No one can tell you, Gary. It's up to you. There are no known infestations near Clive, and the recommendation of every entomologist from here to the Atlantic Ocean is wait and begin treatments when emerald ash borer has approached you and is within 15 miles. So because we don't know of any, we think you don't need to do anything now, but of course you're taking the risk that it's there and we don't know. The second thing is you could just wait and see. That's a perfectly logical thing to do. Another option is go ahead and plant a replacement nearby, so that if you do lose the ash, there'll be something growing there soon. And then finally, if you are going to use a chemical treatment, you need to be very careful in setting emotion aside and saying, how healthy is this tree? Does it have a full canopy? Does it have all the leaves it's supposed to have? Is it growing vigorously? And if you say uh-uh to any of those questions, then it's not a good candidate for the chemical treatment. And we back up to number two, which is starter replacement. Only vigorously growing healthy trees will justify the treatment. And remember, if you do go down that line, it's going to be at least every other year and maybe every year for the rest of your life, for as long as you want to keep treating that tree. So this is a hard decision to make, and there is no one right answer, but you need to be thinking about this and looking around and seeing what else you've got in your neighborhood.
And as we were talking about earlier in the hour, you also have to take into account the impact of the insecticide.
Which depends on the size of the tree. I'm kind of guessing he was talking about a larger tree that would be too large for a do-it-yourself treatment. So now you're talking hiring a professional to come in and inject. And they actually drill little holes and inject the chemical into the trunk just under the bark so that there's no treatment to other plants that are growing nearby. For budget purposes, if you think about having someone come treat your tree, calculate the diameter of your tree and then multiply that by $10 or $12 per inch. That's what it's going to cost you to treat that tree on rough average, about $10 to $12 per diameter inch is what the treatment will cost. And you figure that into your calculations compared to the price of removal and replacement.
All right. Another email. This is from Rita. In March, we tapped box elder trees in our yard and collected 40 gallons of sap before finally pulling the spiles and boiled it down to a gallon of syrup. It's really good. We're assuming that the pesticides we put around, that we put around the base of the trees last fall to kill Creeping Charlie is not present in our syrup. Is that something they should be concerned about?
Well, they used a herbicide to control Creeping Charlie. We don't know which one it is, but let's assume it was 2,4-D. That's not systemic, is it, Richard?
I don't believe so, no.
No. So we would not expect the herbicide to be taken up in the tree the way we've talked about the systemic insecticides. Now, Roundup is systemic, but it only moves in that plant, the plant that it was applied to. It wouldn't be moving into other nearby plants. So the answer, from the best head-scratching here in the studio is probably not.
All right. And this is from Katie and Clive. We have a large amount of field grass that has infiltrated our front yard. It stands out from the rest of the lawn, and it grows a lot faster. What would be the best way to get rid of the field grass that will also provide the least amount of damage to the rest of the lawn?
Well, field grass is a vague term. I'm not sure exactly what grass that would be. If it's a perennial-type grass, whether it's quack grass or whatever, if it's a perennial type grass, about the only ways to do that would be either to dig it up, physically dig it up and destroy it, or using Roundup, because there would be nothing selective that would kill it and not the other grasses. So either physically digging it up or using Roundup possibly.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. This is Brenda in Preston. Hello, Brenda.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
My question is about raking lawns in the spring. I had read an article a couple of years ago about the potential danger of ruining root systems by raking too early in the spring. And I just wondered what the reading on that is presently.
Well, I actually did it last weekend on Saturday myself. And basically I did that to kind of clean up some of the debris. The grass was kind of matted down, so I did it basically to kind of air it out. And so you can do it in the spring. Just don't be too rough with it. Make sure it's not too wet when you do it. If it's really wet, maybe put it off for a few days. But no, you want to do it in the spring, and it helps to waken up the grass a little bit earlier.
And if you're destroying the root system by raking, you're working way too hard.
Okay. Well, I'll make sure I don't do that.
No, don't work too hard.
Thank you very much.
Brenda, thank you very much for your call. Next up, we've got Bill on the line in Urbandale. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill. Bill. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I've changed my question because I just thought I have heavy shade, okay, maples, and I'm tired of putting shade lawn seed down. Mm-hmm. And I was just wanting to know, is there a hardy type, like a clover or something I could put down that's also edible for the animals or something I could put down that's more practical and hardy?
Well, I don't think the clover would do very well either in the shade.
Oh.
Maples have a very, very extensive root system. It's very shallow. They're a very, very keen competitor. And so it's very difficult to grow a lot of things beneath a maple tree because it just gets most of the water, nutrients, and you also have the shading. So it's a very difficult environment. You could simply mulch it with wood chips around the tree. That would be a possibility. Or you could try maybe some really tough ground cover, very vigorous, possibly something like creeping liriope or labriope, or maybe some of the hostas. Some of the hostas like Hosta lancifolia, they're very, very aggressive plants themselves. So,
all right. I hope that answers your question, Bill. Did that cover it? That cover it, Bill?
I was talking about 1,000 square feet or whatever, about a 10 by 100 that's shaded.
Right.
You were talking about like little spots up by the roots. I was wondering about the whole area.
Well, you could mulch large areas beneath it with like wood chips and maybe toward the outer edge of that area maybe put in some ground cover plants to kind of look nice. So, but it's going to be very hard to grow almost anything beneath that tree.
Mm-hmm. All right, Bill, thanks a lot for your call. We also had a call from John in Iowa City who had to go off the line, but he just bought a property that has a lot of multifloral rose in his timber. How do you get rid of it?
Boy, that's a tough one. There are herbicides that you can use. I think herbicides would be the option. I think we do have some information on the internet. If you go to Iowa State University, type in, for example, multifloral rose control recommendations, that should go to it. But I think it's going to be mainly herbicides.
Or dig them out, dig them out, dig them out.
Repeatedly.
And a lot of people have been fighting that battle for a long time. So welcome. Welcome to the fight.
Welcome to our world.
All right. This is an email from Karen. I saw an ash tree on a commercial property in Des Moines that has peeling bark. Who should I contact to see if it's infected with emerald ash borer? I'm sure that's a question a lot of people have.
Yes. And all the agencies of the emerald ash borer team can help. And one of the options is to send a digital picture of that tree to insects@iastate.edu, and Iowa State University Extension will evaluate the situation for you. If necessary, the Iowa Department of Agriculture, Office of the State Entomologist, can help. Also, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, there in Des Moines, can also help. The USDA is not doesn't do as much field work on this type of thing as do our other agencies. So Iowa State University can help, Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, or Iowa Department of Natural Resources. And it doesn't matter which one of the three of us you contact because we all get together and share what we know anyway. So we'll all end up seeing your pictures if you send those to us.
Okay, and a quick final question from Laura. I'm considering starting a milkweed patch to help the monarchs, and I have a question. First, the question is, will the seeds spread to other places where I don't want the milkweed?
That shouldn't be a big problem, no, I wouldn't think. As far as a well-maintained yard and garden, no, I don't think so, no.
All right. And she's also concerned about that white seed stuff being a nuisance. But you can have different kinds of milkweed, right, Donald?
Yes, you can. You can plant the butterfly milkweed, mm-hmm. which is a prairie plant, which makes very small pods, or cut the pods off as they start to green up and you won't have the white milkweed fluff.
All right. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity. Always a pleasure.
ISU horticulturist Richard Duran, thank you.
You're welcome.
And we'll be back with Hort Day next Friday when I assume it will be spring by next Friday with me in the studio.
Maybe.
Yeah. With me in the studio now is Ben Kiefer. What's coming up on River to River today?
At noon, we'll look at the latest on the investigation into the massive Yonkers building fire last weekend. Also, a conversation with David Skorton, former University of Iowa president. He has been named the new secretary of the Smithsonian Institute. David Skorton on our program over the noon hour.
All right, River to River coming up today at noon with Ben Kiefer. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.